Chapter 5. Discount. He remained in Cincinnati that winter 1856-57, working at his trade. No letters have been preserved from that time, except two that were sent to a Keokuk weekly, the Saturday Post, and as these were written for publication, and are rather a poor attempt at burlesque humor, their chief feature being a pretended illiteracy, they would seem to bear no relation to this collection. He roomed that winter with a rugged, self-educated Scotchman, a mechanic, but a man of books and philosophies, who left an impress on Mark Twain's mental life. In April he took up once more the journey toward South America, but presently forgot the Amazon altogether in the new career that opened to him. All through his boyhood and youth Samuel Clemens had wanted to be a pilot. Now came the long-deferred opportunity. On the little Cincinnati steamer, the Paul Jones, there was a pilot named Horace Bixby. Young Clemens idling in the pilot house was one morning seized with the old ambition, and laid siege to Bixby, to teach him the river. The terms finally agreed upon specified a fee to Bixby of $500, 100 down, the balance when the pupil had completed the course, and was earning money. But all this has been told in full elsewhere, and is only summarized here, because the letters fail to complete the story. Bixby soon made some trips up the Missouri River, and in his absence turned his apprentice, over to other pilots, such being the river custom. Young Clemens, in love with the life, and a favorite with his superiors, had a happy time until he came under a pilot named Brown. Brown was illiterate and tyrannical, and from the beginning of their association pilot and apprentice disliked each other cordially. It is at this point that the letters begin once more, the first having been written when young Clemens, now 22 years old, had been on the river nearly a year. Life with Brown, of course, was not all sorrow, and in this letter we find some of the fierce joy of adventure which in those days Samuel Clemens loved. To Onion Clemens and wife, in Keokuk, Iowa. St. Louis, March 9, 1858. Dear brother and sister, I must take advantage of the opportunity now presented to write you, but I shall necessarily be dull, as I feel uncommonly stupid. We have had a hard trip this time. Left St. Louis 3 weeks ago on the Pennsylvania. The weather was very cold, and the ice running densely. We got 15 miles below town, landed the boat, and then one pilot. Second mate and four deckhands took the sounding boat, and shoved out in the ice to hunt the channel. They failed to find it, and the ice drifted them ashore. The pilot left the men with the boat and walked back to us, a mile and a half. Then the other pilot and myself, with a larger crew of men started out, and met with the same fate. We drifted ashore just below the other boat. Then the fun commenced. We made fast a line 20 fathoms long, to the bow of the yawl, and put the men, both crews, to it like horses, on the shore. Brown, the pilot, stood in the bow, with an oar, to keep her head out, and I took the tiller. We would start the men, and all would go well till the yawl would bring up on a heavy cake of ice, and then the men would drop like so many 10 pins, while Brown assumed the horizontal in the bottom of the boat. After an hour's hard work we got back, with ice half an inch thick on the oars. Sent back and warped up the other yawl, and then George, the first mentioned pilot, and myself, took a double crew of fresh men, and tried it again. This time we found the channel in less than half an hour, and landed on an island till the Pennsylvania came along, and took us off. The next day was colder still. I was out in the yawl twice, and then we got through, but the infernal steamboat came near running over us. We went 10 miles further, landed, and George and I cleared out again, found the channel first trial, but got caught in the gorge, and drifted helplessly down the river. The ocean spray came along and started into the ice after us, but although she didn't succeed in her kind intention of taking us aboard, her waves washed us out, and that was all we wanted. We landed on an island, built a big fire and waited for the boat. She started, and ran aground. It commenced raining and sleeting, and a very interesting time we had on that barren sandbar for the next 4 hours, when the boat got off and took us aboard. The next day was terribly cold. We sounded at island, warped up around a bar and sounded again, but in order to understand our situation you will have to read Dr. Kane. It would have been impossible to get back to the boat. But the Maria Denning was aground at the head of the island. They hailed us, we ran alongside, and they hoisted us in, and thawed us out. We had then been out in the yawl from 4 o'clock in the morning till 9:30 without being near a fire. There was a thick coating of ice over men, yawl, ropes and everything else, and we looked like rock candy statuary. We got to St. Louis this morning, after an absence of 3 weeks that boat generally makes the trip in two. Henry was doing little or nothing here, and I sent him to our clerk, to work his way for a trip, by measuring wood piles, counting coal boxes, and other clerkly duties, which he performed satisfactorily. He may go down with us again, for I expect he likes our bill of fare better than that of his boarding house. I got your letter at Memphis as I went down. That is the best place to write me at. The post office here is always out of my route, somehow or other. Remember the direction: SLC, Steamer Pennsylvania Care Duval and Algeo, Wharf Boat, Memphis. I cannot correspond with a paper, because when one is learning the river, he is not allowed to do or think about anything else. I am glad to see you in such high spirits about the land, and I hope you will remain so, if you never get richer. I seldom venture to think about our landed wealth, for hope deferred maketh the heart sick. I did intend to answer your letter, but I am too lazy, and too sleepy now. We have had a rough time during the last 24 hours working through the ice between Cairo and St. Louis, and I have had but little rest. I got here too late to see the funeral of the 10 victims by the burning of the Pacific Hotel in 7th Street. Ma says there were 10 hearses, with the fire companies, their engines in mourning, firemen in uniform, the various benevolent societies in uniform and mourning, and a multitude of citizens and strangers, forming, altogether, a procession of 30,000 persons. One steam fire engine was drawn by 4 white horses, with crepe festoons on their heads. Well, I am just about asleep here, Brother Sam. Among other things, we gather from this letter that Orion Clemens had faith in his brother as a newspaper correspondent, though the 2 contributions from Cincinnati, already mentioned, were not promising. Furthermore, we get an intimation of Orion's unfailing confidence in the future of the, and that is to say, the great tract of land in eastern Tennessee which, in an earlier day, his father had bought as a heritage for his children. It is the same Tennessee land that had aliens in it for Colonel Sellers, the land that would become, as Orion Clemens long afterward phrased it, he worry of 3 generations. The Dr. Kane of this letter is, of course, Dr. Elisha Kent Kane, the American Arctic explorer. Any book of exploration always appealed to Mark Twain, and in those days Kane was a favorite. The paragraph concerning Henry and his employment on the Pennsylvania begins the story of a tragedy. The story has been fully told elsewhere. Mark Twain. A biography, by same author. And need only be sketched briefly here. Henry, a gentle, faithful boy, shared with his brother the enmity of the pilot Brown. Some 2 months following the date of the foregoing letter, on a down trip of the Pennsylvania, an unprovoked attack made by Brown upon the boy brought his brother Sam to the rescue. Brown received a good pummeling at the hands of the future humorist, who, though upheld by the captain, decided to quit the Pennsylvania at New Orleans, and to come up the river by another boat. The Brown episode has no special bearing on the main tragedy, though now in retrospect it seems closely related to it. Samuel Clemens, coming up the river on the A.T. Lacy, 2 days behind the Pennsylvania, heard a voice shout as they approached the Greenville, Mississippi, landing. Pennsylvania is blown up just below Memphis, at Ship Island. 150 lives lost. It was a true report. At 6 o'clock of a warm, mid-June morning, while loading wood, 60 miles below Memphis, the Pennsylvania's boilers had exploded with fearful results. Henry Clemens was among the injured. He was still alive when his brother reached Memphis on the Lacey, but died a few days later. Samuel Clemens had idolized the boy and regarded himself responsible for his death. The letter that follows shows that he was overwrought by the scenes about him and the strain of watching, yet the anguish of it is nonetheless real. To Mrs. Onion Clemens, Memphis, Tennessee, Friday, June 18, 1858. Dear Sister Molly, long before this reaches you, my poor Henry, my darling, my pride, my glory, my all, will have finished his blameless career, and the light of my life will have gone out in utter darkness. Oh, God! This is hard to bear. Hardened, hopeless, I, lost, and ruined sinner as I am, I have humbled myself to the ground, and prayed as never man prayed before, that the great God might let this cup pass from me, that he would strike me to the earth, but spare my brother, that he would pour out the fullness of his just wrath upon my wicked head, but have mercy, mercy, mercy upon that unoffending boy. The horrors of 3 days have swept over me. They have blasted my youth and left me an old man before my time. Molly, there are gray hairs in my head tonight. For 48 hours I labored at the bedside of my poor burned and bruised but uncomplaining brother, and then the star of my hope went out and left me in the gloom of despair. Men take me by the hand and congratulate me, and call me lucky, because I was not on the Pennsylvania when she blew up. May God forgive them, for they know not what they say. Molly, you do not understand why I was not on that boat, I will tell you. I left St. Louis on her, but on the way down, Mr. Brown, the pilot that was killed by the explosion, poor fellow, quarreled with Henry without cause, while I was steering. Henry started out of the pilot house, Brown jumped up, and collared him, turned him halfway around, and struck him in the face. And him nearly 6 feet high struck my little brother. I was wild from that moment. I left the boat to steer herself, and avenged the insult, and the captain said I was right that he would discharge Brown in New Orleans, if he could get another pilot, and would do it in St. Louis, anyhow. Of course both of us could not return to St. Louis on the same boat, no pilot could be found, and the captain sent me to the A.T. Lacey, with orders to her captain, to bring me to St. Louis. Had another pilot been found, poor Brown would have been the lucky man. I was on the Pennsylvania 5 minutes before she left New Orleans, and I must tell you the truth, Molly, 300 human beings perished by that fearful disaster. Henry was asleep, was blown up, then fell back on the hot boilers, and I suppose that rubbish fell on him, for he is injured internally. He got into the water, and swam to shore, and got into the flatboat with the other survivors. Henry had returned once to the Pennsylvania, to render assistance to the passengers. Later he had somehow made his way to the flatboat. He had nothing on but his wet shirt, and he lay there burning up with a southern sun and freezing in the wind till the Kate Frisbee came along. His wounds were not dressed till he got to Memphis, 15 hours after the explosion. He was senseless and motionless for 12 hours after that. But may God bless Memphis, the noblest city on the face of the earth. As he has done her duty by these poor afflicted creatures, especially Henry, for he has had 5, 10, 15, 20 times the care and attention that anyone else has had. Dr. Payton, the best physician in Memphis, he is exactly like the portraits of Webster, sat by him for 36 hours. There are 32 scalded men in that room, and you would know Dr. Payton better than I can describe him, if you could follow him around, and hear each man murmur as he passes, "May the God of heaven bless you, doctor. The ladies have done well too. Our second mate, a handsome, noble-hearted young fellow, will die. Yesterday a beautiful girl of 15 stooped timidly down by his side, and handed him a pretty bouquet. The poor suffering boy's eyes kindled, his lips quivered out a gentle, "Ah, bless you, miss," and he burst into tears. He made them write her name on a card for him, that he might not forget it. "Pray for me, Molly, and pray for my poor sinless brother. Your unfortunate brother, Saml. 50. Clemens. P.S. I got here 2 days after Henry. It is said that Mark Twain never really recovered from the tragedy of his brother's death, that it was responsible for the serious, pathetic look that the face of the world's greatest laugh maker always wore in repose. He went back to the river, and in September of the same year, after an apprenticeship of less than 18 months, received his license as a St. Louis and New Orleans pilot, and was accepted by his old chief, Bixby, as full partner on an important boat. In Life on the Mississippi, Mark Twain makes the period of his study from 2 to 2.5 years, but this is merely an attempt to magnify his dullness. He was, in fact, an apt pupil and a pilot of very high class. Clemens was now suddenly lifted to a position of importance. The Mississippi River pilot of those days was a person of distinction, earning a salary then regarded as princely. Certainly $250 a month was large for a boy of 23. At once, of course, he became the head of the Clemens family. His brother Orion was 10 years older, but he had not the gift of success. By common consent, the younger brother assumed permanently the position of family counselor and financier. We expect him to feel the importance of his new position, and he is too human to disappoint us. Incidentally, we notice an improvement in his English. He no longer writes "Between you and I," fragment of a letter to Orion Clemens, written at St. Louis in 1859. I am not talking nonsense, now I am in earnest. I want you to keep your troubles and your plans out of the reach of meddlers, until the latter are consummated, so that in case you fail, no one will know it but yourself. Above all things, between you and me, never tell my any of your troubles. She never slept a wink the night your last letter came, and she looks distressed yet. Write only cheerful news to her. You know that she will not be satisfied so long as she thinks anything is going on that she is ignorant of, and she makes a little fuss about it when her suspicions are awakened. But that makes no difference. I know that it is better that she be kept in the dark concerning all things of an unpleasant nature. She upbraids me occasionally for giving her only the bright side of my affairs, but unfortunately for her she has to put up with it, for I know that troubles that I curse a while and forget would disturb her slumbers for some time. (2) Possibly because she is deprived of the soothing consolation of swearing. Tell her the good news and me the bad. Putting all things together, I begin to think I am rather lucky than otherwise, a notion which I was slow to take up. The other night I was about to round to for a storm, but concluded that I could find a smoother bank somewhere. I landed 5 miles below. The storm came, passed away, and did not injure us. Coming up, day before yesterday, I looked at the spot I first chose, and half the trees on the bank were torn to shreds. We couldn't have lived 5 minutes in such a tornado. And I am also lucky in having a berth, while all the young pilots are idle. This is the luckiest circumstance that ever befell me. Not on account of the wages, for that is a secondary consideration, but from the fact that the city of Memphis is the largest boat in the trade and the hardest to pilot, and consequently I can get a reputation on her, which is a thing I never could accomplish on a transient boat. I can ank in the neighborhood of $100 a month on her, and that will satisfy me for the present, principally because the other youngsters are sucking their fingers. Bless me! What a pleasure there is in revenge! And what vast respect prosperity commands! Why, 6 months ago, I could enter the Ooms and receive only a customary fraternal greeting, but now they say, why, how? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.